using his quarry. Finally, the road straightened out some, and Dom backed off 100 yards to stay out of sight in the snow. It took a moment to get his hand under his butt to pull his glove off, but he managed, careful to keep his glove in place while he dialed his phone. After 4 rings, Dom heard a recording in his earpiece. "You've reached Supervisory Special Agent Darren Albright. I am unavailable at this time. Please leave a detailed message. Good day." Fuck. The state-of-the-art Bluetooth headset in his ear and the sound-dampening effects of the helmet made the call relatively clear, but still Dom had to all but shout over his bike's engine. "Albright, it's me. Ross, Bertoli, and several armed subjects are in a white 12-passenger van heading... I guess this must be south. We crossed the Pont du Mont Blanc and are on... Hold up while I pass a sign. We're on Route du Malignon. I need HRT on them quick before they get to wherever they're going. Call me back." He disconnected the call. Dom had to tighten up on the van again as it entered a hilly section in a southwestern neighborhood, and then he backed off when it took the wide and straight Rue Blanche. He almost lost it once in the snowstorm, but he pressed his luck and closed, and this paid off, because he caught sight of the white vehicle just as it took an access ramp for the highway. They got on the A40, which Dom thought was good news, because he knew it would have been impossible to stick on the van much longer without being spotted as it traveled up and down city streets. But the bad news was there were fewer cars and trucks on the highway, and Caruso was certain he stood out more now. As the vehicle picked up speed, it blended in with the snow much better than his black bike, dark gray riding suit, and black helmet. But he concentrated on keeping as far back as he could and retaining as much of his vision as possible by wiping his visor with the left forearm of his suit every 20 seconds or so. Dom could not be sure Darren Albright would pick up his message in time to catch up with Ross. The Swiss police might have already detained the FBI team, or else simply delayed them, which, as far as Dom was concerned, would be just as bad. So he called Adara, who answered on the first ring. "Where are you? I came back to the Four Seasons. This place is crawling with police." Dom explained where he was. "What can I do?" "Call Jerry and get the name of the CIA station chiefs in Geneva, Milan, and Lyon. They are the closest cities with stations. Then get those people on the phone. If you can't get the COSs, find the DCOSs. Whoever you can get, tell them the situation." Adara hesitated. "Right. Just so I know, what exactly is the situation?" "Good question. First, don't tell them who you are or who I am. Just say Ethan Ross is traveling southeast on the A40 in a white van. Tag number Golf Echo 3899772. Destination unknown. He's got a half dozen or so armed subjects with him, possibly Palestinians, but I'm just guessing." "Okay. They might want me to establish my bona fides somehow." "Tell them you work for Darren Albright, FBI-CID. If those station chiefs are worth a damn, they'll move mountains to get that intel back from Ross. They'll check into the tipster later." "I'm on it," Adara said, and Dom disconnected the phone and struggled to get his glove back on. For nearly 15 minutes, Caruso drove through the snow alone, with a faint view of the van's taillights, the pounding in his heart. Adrenaline from the early stages of the chase was dissipating, and only the motorcycle's drone remained. His headset chirped in his ear, startling him. He accepted the call by pulling off his glove again and pressing a button on his phone with his thumb. "Albright?"
"What the fuck, Caruso? You're here? In Geneva?"
"Actually, I'm outside the city, rolling through the Alps, still headed southeast."
"What are you doing in Switzerland?"
"Right now I'm tailing your target. What are you doing still in Geneva?" "One of my teams got held up by the Canton police. We think Ross was tipped off by locals somehow, and that's why they were ready for us."
"Wouldn't doubt it."
Albright asked, "How many are with you?"
"How many what?"
"How many men on your team?"
"Team? There is no team. I'm flying solo. It's just me. I'm on a BMW bike chasing this bastard through a snowstorm. Bullshit. I know you were running an agency operation. Tell you what, when you catch up, you'll see I'm alone, and then you can snag Ross and take all the glory. I'm en route with 5 men. The other trucks are headed north to pull off the police. Dom passed through the small hamlet of Bonneville, but he was still on the A-40, and Ross showed no hint of exiting the highway here. Dom gave Albright this information, and Albright put Caruso on hold for some time so he could confer with his team. After a few minutes, he came back on the line. Okay, looks like you're 10 minutes ahead of us, tops. They're heading straight into the mountains. With this shitty weather, we're not going to be able to call up air transport, but that's actually good news. Ross and his people won't be flying out of here. If you can keep up with them and lead us to them, we'll catch up, and we'll fight them on the ground and end this thing today. Dom had considered the weather and come to the same conclusion. No helicopter pilot in the world would risk flying in this shit. Any clue where they're going? In a few minutes, they'll be over the French border in Chamonix. From there, it's a right turn into the Italian Alps. I don't know how that helps them. Maybe they've got a safe house. Maybe they just need a bolt hole till the weather passes and they can fly out. Caruso said, if they exit the highway, it's going to be impossible for me to stay with them for long. Understood. We're closing fast. I'll call you when I can see you. Caruso added one more thing. There's something you don't know. At this point, Ross is unwitting in all this. I saw him try to make a run for it. The armed guys have him and maybe Bertoli at gunpoint. Albright responded without hesitation. That complicates things for Ross, but not for me. When we go in for the arrest, I am treating everyone as hostile. Dom nodded in his helmet as he drove. Can't say I blame you there. 46. As Caruso and Albright suspected, Ross and his kidnappers left the highway in the French border town of Chamonix and turned onto a road that led to the Mont Blanc Tunnel, a 7.2-mile passage under Mont Blanc, the highest mountain in Europe. On the other side was Italy. Dom quickly called Albright back and informed him of this before entering the tunnel, where his phone promptly became useless to him. Inside the Mont Blanc Tunnel, Dom immediately dropped almost a mile back from the white van so he wouldn't be detected. When he exited the tunnel into Italy 10 minutes later, he returned to the poor visibility of the snowstorm, and he could no longer see Ross's vehicle ahead of him. He floored the bike to try to close the distance between himself and his target, and he tried to call Albright back to update him, but Dom found himself alternately in the basin of a narrow valley or racing through one of many more tunnels cut into the mountainsides, so he remained out of comms with the FBI team behind him. Fortunately, he caught a glimpse of the van in the distance, and he locked onto its taillights a few 100 yards away and concentrated on keeping a fixed distance. After traveling more than 10 miles into Italy, the van pulled off the A-5 and onto the SS-26, a 2-lane winding road that worked its way through the foothills on the northern wall of the valley. Soon after, Dom's headset chirped in his ear. Albright? Yeah. Okay, we're right behind you. Saw your taillight as you turned onto the SS-26. Ross is still in front of you. He's a quarter mile ahead tops. Albright said, I want you to pull off at the next exit and shoot ahead of him through the town of Saint-Maurice. That will get you out of our line of fire and ahead in case we blow the felony stop and he squirts free. Understood, Dom said. I'll go through the town and wait on the road ahead until I hear back from you. Albright said, you're armed, right? Negative. I hope he doesn't squirt, because I won't be able to stop him. Good luck. Yep. Albright hung up. Albright and his 5 men traveled 3 to a vehicle in a pair of identical silver Ford Expeditions. They'd spent the last several minutes racing into and out of nearly a dozen mountain tunnels, where they sped up to over 100 miles an hour before slowing back down to 50 when they came out of the tunnels onto the slick streets.
This tactic had allowed them to catch up to the fleeing American trader, and now they could see his vehicle just 50 yards ahead as they entered yet another tunnel. Albright's driver asked, "Want to do it in a tunnel or on the open road?" Albright said, "Open road. As shitty as the weather is, we can use it to get up on their ass undetected and use the poor road conditions to help with the stop." "Roger that." Albright ordered the other expedition to initiate the stop, so the agent driving the other truck waited until they left the tunnel, and he was obscured in the storm. Then he began advancing on the target vehicle. In both expeditions, the men clutched their short-barreled M4 carbines, or, in Albright's case, he put his hand on the grip of his SIG pistol in his waistband, and they readied themselves for the high-risk felony stop just a few seconds away. Ethan Ross had spent the last several minutes with his eyes fixed on Mohammed. The Iranian sat with his phone pressed to his ear almost constantly. He was conferring with someone. It sounded like it was Arabic and not Farsi, but Ross could not be sure. Ross didn't speak either language, but he had understood one thing Mohammed had said. After several loud, almost angry outbursts, the Iranian said an unmistakable phrase in English. "Track my iPhone." Ross and Bertoli exchanged confused glances. While Mohammed barked into his mobile phone, the driver of the van looked into the rearview mirror and shouted an alarm. Again, Ross had no understanding of what was being said, but he pieced it together when all the Iranians swiveled their heads around and looked behind them. Ross followed suit, and he saw a silver SUV racing up from behind in the left lane. Ross assumed it was nothing more than a crazy driver ignoring the awful conditions, but the Iranians began reaching for their weapons in their coats. Ross ducked down in his seat, still keeping his eyes out the window, and still expecting the vehicle to pass. But to his horror, the silver SUV merged quickly into the van's lane. The right front quarter panel of the Ford truck made contact with the left rear quarter of the van briefly, knocking it gently. And that was all it took. The driver of the van shouted, and Ross realized the man had lost control. The nose of the van angled to the left, and the rear tires slid to the right. Soon everyone inside was grabbing on to something or someone, and the van began skating sideways on the two-lane road at over 50 miles an hour. Ross slammed into Bertoli as the van skidded 180 degrees. It showed no sign of slowing as it left the road and impacted a guardrail, then scraped along and shot backward. At the end of the guardrail, the van left the road and slid slowly backward down a 30-foot-long snow-covered hill. It stopped in a drift and teetered, finally tipping over, crashing down on its side in a foot of snow. Ross ended up on top of Gianna Bertoli in the back of the van. Mohammed and three Quds men were pressed together in front of them, and in the front, the driver and the passenger were still strapped in their seats. Quickly, men clambered over one another to get out through the driver's side doors. One after another, they rolled off the side of the van and they dropped into the snow, taking cover behind the hood and the roof. Ross heard the back door of the van open behind him, and then he felt hands on his jacket, his belt, and even in his hair. Two men pulled him roughly out and into the snow. He screamed in pain as his hair was wrenched nearly out of the scalp. For a brief moment, he lay alone on his back by the rear of the van. From his position, he had a view of the road above him, and he saw two silver Ford Expeditions parked there. Several men appeared. They crouched with rifles pointed down in his direction. Even though Ross lay on his back, he raised his hands high in the air. Just then someone grabbed him by his ankles and pulled him around the roof of the van, removing him from the line of fire. He looked around quickly. Gianna was sitting in the snow with her back against the van's roof. She seemed dazed, and a black and blue bruise that covered her right cheek and eye socket told him she'd been injured in the crash of the van. The Iranian men in the ski jackets were all around. The two who had pulled him around the van joined up with the others. They knelt or squatted low behind the van, and they all held black pistols in their hands. They swiveled their heads back and forth between the road above them and Mohammed, down here behind the van on his knees. Ross looked at Mohammed now, and realized the Iranian was, incredibly, still talking on his telephone. What the fuck? Just then he heard the squawk of a bullhorn. Ethan Ross, can you hear me? Ross answered instinctively. Yes. Tell your men to put down their weapons. Ross was confused. He looked around him. My men?
They aren't my men. I'm a prisoner.
The amplified voice said, I want to see guns in the snow now. Bertoli crawled frantically over to Mohammed, grabbing at his arm and pulling the phone away from his ear.
We must surrender. My friends here in Italy will protect us. Please, don't do anything.
Mohammed backhanded her with enough force to knock her onto her back, and he kept talking into his phone. From above, the man with the loudspeaker said, I need you to comply immediately or we will be forced to... Mohammed shouted something in Farsi, and then, with no hesitation, his six men stepped out on either side of the van and opened fire uphill at the men in the road. Ross cowered into the fetal position and covered his ears. He closed his eyes. Hot brass ejected from the pistols and landed all around him. Gunfire from above boomed louder than the pistols. Within 5 seconds, Ross felt a blow to his head. He opened his eyes and saw that an Iranian had fallen on top of him. He was dead where he fell, his black-clad leg and ski boot lying atop Ross. A man on the far side of the toppled van dropped to his knees and his pistol tumbled free. He clutched at his throat, and Ethan watched as a geyser of blood spurted through his fingers. He let out a garbled cry, and then another spray of blood exploded out the back of his head. He flopped onto his back in the snow as the men next to him kept firing. Darren Albright positioned himself at the rear axle of one of the expeditions, keeping the vehicle between himself and the Iranians shooting. He had his SIG pistol in his hand, but the 5 HRT men were laying down withering fire on the armed men below. After 30 seconds of incessant shooting, there was a break in the gunfire. Albright saw that one of the HRT men had been hit, but he'd been dragged back to cover by another agent, and he appeared to be only lightly wounded. The others expertly moved wide on both sides of the road. Albright knew they would try to hit the men below from the flanks simultaneously. He covered their movement with his pistol, ready to lay down fire on anything that appeared from behind the toppled van. Albright was the first to hear the noise. He cocked his head and looked up to the sky as the faint but unmistakable thumping of a helicopter's rotors filled the air. In this weather, the helo was a surreal sound, and within seconds every last member of the FBI hostage rescue team followed Albright's gaze into the sky. The snowfall was heavy and constant. It seemed as if the clouds were no more than 20 feet above the ground. Albright brought his radio to his mouth. That helo does not belong to us. Who the fuck is flying in this? A blue and white helicopter appeared out of the gray soup just over the highway, less than 100 yards away. It skimmed 20 feet off the road surface and closed on the 2 SUVs, and it pivoted 90 degrees, revealing an open, sliding side door. Figures were visible moving inside. Like something from a nightmare, Albright saw flashes come from the helo's interior, and he heard the quick staccato sounds of automatic gunfire. The first SUV on the road shook on its chassis as copper-jacketed lead tore through its aluminum skin. An FBI agent near Albright swung his weapon up toward the new threat, but he immediately spasmed and fell, blood erupting from his legs and lower torso and splattering across the snow-streaked highway. Albright dove for the deck and shouted into his mic, "Engage that fucking helo!" 47. A cell of 6 Hezbollah operators from Lyon, France, sat strapped inside the Eurocopter EC-145 that streaked sideways over the snow-swept Italian highway. Five men were in the back, firing down on the Americans on the road with their mishmash of automatic weapons, while one man sat in the co-pilot seat and held his CZ-9mm pistol to the head of the pilot. His name was Ajis. He was the leader of this cell and the oldest at 24, and he had been in near constant communication with the Iranian Revolutionary Guards officer running this operation for most of the past 24 hours. From the moment Mohammed Mobasheri arrived in Geneva and saw the welcome reception of ITP members, he decided he might need to snatch Ross out of the hands of the ITP to satisfy his mission parameters. To do this, he began planning a way to effect the abduction. He was well aware the weather would be turning bad. The winter storm was all over the news because it was coming so late in the season. But he didn't think he could take Ross overland all the way to the Mediterranean, a 5-hour drive. Mohammed knew he needed a helicopter and a pilot, and with the approaching storm he decided he would need the best pilot available to travel in the miserable winter conditions. He did some Google research the previous afternoon and found a private helicopter rescue company that operated in the area. Their helos were responsible for plucking injured climbers off of Mont Blanc, as well as other mountains in the Graian Alps, so he decided they would be best suited to the horrible conditions coming. He ordered the Lyon cell of Hezbollah men to hijack a helicopter and a pilot from the service, and to have it meet him on the road outside of Geneva. More research showed Mobasheri that he could mask the flight of the helicopter on radar if it flew low through the Alps, so he made the decision to move the transfer of Ross from the van to the helicopter to somewhere in the Aosta Valley, the nearest suitable location. The 6 Hezbollah operatives had arrived at the hangar of Mont Blanc copter services at 10 o'clock that morning. Flight operations had been canceled because of the snowstorm, but the staff lived on the mountain, so they showed up to do paperwork and routine maintenance. There was no security on the property, just a secretary at a desk, 3 maintenance men, 2 pilots, and a receptionist. Ajiz and his team took the entire staff at gunpoint into an office, where he demanded to know which of the 2 pilots had more experience. Neither man spoke up, but a photograph on the receptionist's desk told Ajiz what he needed to know. Claudette, the 30-year-old receptionist, was the daughter of the 56-year-old pilot named Henri. The Hezbollah cell commander knew instantly. He could use this to his advantage. The French pilot told the young Middle Easterners that they were mad if they thought anyone could fly in such poor visibility. The honest truth was, no one in the Lyon cell wanted to fly in this weather any more than the Frenchmen did, but they had their orders from Mohammed, and they knew failing to carry them out would mean a certain death sentence back in Lebanon for themselves and their families. The French pilot and his daughter were pulled into the hangar, and the others were lashed with tie-down chains and locked together in a supply room off the hangar with padlocks from the storage doors. They weren't killed, because Mohammed had passed orders on to Ajiz mandating that he keep them alive. He knew the pilot would need the incentive of believing he would be left alive at the end of the operation. Killing the others would tip him off that even his total compliance would not save him and his daughter. Ajiz ordered the pilot to fuel and pre-flight the largest craft in the hangar, a blue Eurocopter EC-145. Then he, his daughter, and the 6 Hezbollah operators from Lyon rolled it out into the heavy snow on a trailer. The pilot begged the armed men to reconsider, telling them they would all likely slam into a mountain before they accomplished whatever the hell it was they were planning. Ajiz just strapped in beside him and waved his gun, while Claudette was placed in the back in the middle of the rest of the Lyon cell. Ajiz put on his headset and told the Frenchmen they would be heading somewhere down in the valley, and he'd provide him more information soon. The helicopter lifted off into the gray. The pilot used his instruments and his radar and his GPS to pick his way forward slowly between the peaks of the mountains, certain they were all going to die, but aware he'd saved his colleagues back in the hangar, and desperately trying to come up with a way to somehow save his daughter as well. The flight was miserable and stressful for all involved, but Ajiz was in comms with Mohammed for most of the flight, and this made things ever more difficult. The pilot flew much slower than Mohammed demanded, but Henri refused to fly faster, even with a CZ pistol jabbed in his neck. By using a locator app from Mobashiri's iPhone, Ajiz was able to direct the pilot to the van on the road, although the iPhone signal was intermittent as the phone entered and exited tunnels. When the Gila reached an altitude of only 25 feet above the highway, the pilot could see both the ground and any wires along the road, and this gave him the confidence to pick up speed. Mobashiri contacted Ajiz seconds after the van crashed down the hill. He told the Lyon cell leader they were under attack, and he ordered the men in the Hilo to engage the Americans and the vehicles on the road. Seconds later, the two silver SUVs appeared 100 yards in front of the helicopter. Ajiz ordered the pilot to turn sideways so the men could shoot out of the side door. Henri feigned trouble with the task, but the butt of an AK-47 rifle to the side of Glaudet's head showed him that he needed to comply. As he flew perpendicular to the highway, Henri heard the heavy gunfire coming out of the cabin of his aircraft. He ducked down as low as he could and hoped his daughter would be able to do the same behind him. A minute earlier, Dominic Caruso raced through the rustic village of Villair as fast as he could without sliding his big bike into the side of a stone house or crashing through a wooden fence. Off his right shoulder and 1,000 yards away, he could hear the rolling echoes of gunfire from both M4 rifles and handguns, and he hurried to get back on the road and get his own weapon into the fray. When he was still several hundred yards away from the SS-26, he backed off on the throttle for a moment because he thought he heard a helicopter overhead. It seemed unlikely. Impossible, really, as there were high hills on both sides of the road here that disappeared into the clouds just feet above his head. The sound disappeared, and he all but dismissed it. But suddenly a new barrage of even more intense gunfire erupted from the site of the FBI traffic stop to the north. It seemed several more guns had entered the fight, and the only explanation Caruso had for it was that somehow the Iranians had managed to show up with reinforcements from the air. He rolled onto the SS-26, turned west toward the gunfight, opened the throttle on his BMW bike, and leaned down behind his little windscreen. He flew headlong through the snowstorm with no idea what he would encounter when he arrived at the battle. Supervisory Special Agent Darren Albright pressed himself tight against the frozen highway. There was no cover from the helicopter above him, so all he could do was fire on it with his pistol and attempt to make himself as small a target as possible out here in the open. Another man from the HRT went down just feet away, and bits of road kicked up around him. The helicopter made a slow pass over the road, still flying sideways. Albright dumped an entire magazine from his pistol at the threat, then he scooped up the fallen tactical officer's rifle. The Hilo spun around quickly to come back for another pass, and Albright flipped the fire selector switch on the rifle to semi-automatic. He aimed at the tail rotor of the aircraft and squeezed off a carefully aimed round. Then a second, then a third. After another shot at the tail rotor, Darren knew he had to take cover behind the SUV on his right because the blue Hilo was heading right for him. He lowered the rifle and started to run, but out of the corner of his eye he saw a man on the hill by the side of the road. It was one of the men from the van, and Albright spun his rifle toward him just as the gunman got him in the sights of his pistol. Albright felt the blow to his right shoulder, well above his body armor, and his gun flew out of his hand. A second round hit his vest, but the third shot slammed into his pelvis, breaking it and buckling the FBI man onto the highway. He fell on his back, his eyes to the sky, as the helicopter flew directly overhead on another gun run. Inside the Eurocopter, two of the Leon cell men were dead, shot by FBI HRT men and still strapped in their seats with their heads bobbing along with the movements of the aircraft. A third man had been hit in the right hand, but he continued firing on the road below with his left hand until he and the others saw the Iranians move up the hill to the road and walk between the human forms lying still there. Ajiz ordered the pilot to land, and Henri did as he was told. As the helicopter touched down, Mohammed Mobasheri climbed to his feet behind the van at the bottom of the hill. He pointed his pistol toward Ethan Ross, who remained on the frozen ground in the fetal position. "Move!" Mobasheri ordered. Ethan stood slowly, his hands in the air, and Gianna Bertoli stood up with him. Together they walked up the hill, with Mohammed bringing up the rear. The French pilot looked to Ajiz while they sat parked on the highway. Through his headset he said, "I want to speak to my daughter." "Why?" "She knows the highway down here. She can help us get away. I only fly up on the mountains." Ajiz looked over his shoulder. The woman's wrists were bound with the straps cut from one of the seats, and she was buckled into another seat. There was blood across her face, but it was blood from one of the dead Hezbollah men and not her own. She sat next to a headset on the wall behind her. He motioned with his pistol for her to put the headset on. She did so, and before she could say anything, Henri spoke to her in Italian. Henri and his daughter were French, but they both knew Italian. He could only pray the Middle Eastern man next to him did not know the language. "When we leave, I will fly low over the mountains. If you can do it, you must get out." "But what about you?" "These men won't let us leave. Believe me, I want you to survive. I will try to survive myself, but only if you are safe."
"I can't leave you,"
he snapped at her. Ajiz glanced at him, but assumed they were arguing about the route through the valley.
"Then we both die today. Please, Claudette, you are the one who can give us both a chance."
Their eyes met. She nodded slightly, and then they discussed the route they would take to the south. The stretch of SS-26 near the idling helicopter was a scattered scene of bodies, blood, and damaged vehicles. Four or five civilian vehicles had stopped in each lane. The drivers had missed the shooting and saw merely what they at first perceived to be a horrific automobile accident and a rescue helicopter. The rotor wash of the helicopter blew the already whipping snow into a blinding torrent and added to the chaos and confusion. Only the first car facing in each direction saw the guns, and the fact the men standing were doing nothing for the men lying in the road. The four Quds Force operatives still alive climbed into the helicopter after unfastening the two dead Lebanese men from the Lyon cell and letting their bodies fall out onto the frozen highway. Ross boarded as ordered. He was shoved into a seat in the back and strapped down. Mobasheri himself was in the back of the group boarding. As the men loaded up, he realized there would not be enough room for everyone. He pushed past Gianna Bertoli as she tried to board, and she was happy to let him take the final place, thinking he would let her go. But as soon as he took his seat, Mohammed turned to Gianna. Over the booming rotor noise, he shouted, "Unfortunately for you, I need Ross, and I need these men. I no longer have any use for you or ITP. His pistol rose quickly, and he shot her through the forehead at a distance of 6 feet. Her head snapped back, her curly black hair flew over her face, and she dropped onto her back on the highway. Ross saw the Swiss woman die. He screamed in shock, and the helicopter lifted off into the snow. 48. As Dominic raced to the scene, he heard the low-flying helicopter churning the air right over his head. He looked up, but he could make out only a slight lightning in the clouds from the aircraft's running lights as it flew by. He still couldn't imagine how in the hell anyone could get airborne in these conditions. Within seconds, he was driving his bike through the after effects of the battle. There were bodies lying motionless on the road. He passed the unmistakable form of Gianna Bertoli. She was on her back, and snow had already blown across her jacket, dusting it with white. He found Albright lying on his side by one of the shot-up silver expeditions. Dom parked the BMW and ran to the man, rolled him onto his back. Albright was alive, but there was blood everywhere. He'd been shot in the shoulder and the hip. He groaned in agony, but he was conscious. He reached out to grab for his mobile phone, which had been knocked several feet away in the gunfight. Dom scooped it up and handed it to him. "Is Ross gone?" Albright nodded. He grunted in pain again, then said,
"Helicopter. I still hear it. It's heading southwest." "Farsi."
"What's that?"
"They were speaking Farsi. They're Iranians."
"That figures,"
said Caruso.
"We've got to let the Italians know,"
Albright said, and groaned. Dom pulled a med kit out of the closest vehicle and returned to Albright, who was dialing a number on the phone with his bloody fingers. Dom knelt to treat the man's wounds, but Albright waved him off.
"Check the others first."
Mohammed Mabashiri was not satisfied with the pilot's performance. They seemed to be flying too slow, though it was difficult to be certain in the near whiteout conditions. The Iranian put on a headset and crawled between the Lyon cell men just behind the pilot seat.
"Go faster!"
He looked to Ajiz in the co-pilot seat, and the Hezbollah man waved his pistol in the man's face. The pilot did not seem to notice. He was covered in sweat, and his eyes were locked on the multifunction display in front of him, worry evident on his face. Ajiz, who had been flying alongside the man for a half hour, noticed a change in the man's behavior.
"What is it?" "A problem."
Mohammed held his own pistol to the pilot's head.
"You lie. You will fly this helicopter south, to Genoa."
The pilot spoke into his mic.
"It's the tail rotor." "What is wrong? It's not responding properly."
Mobashiri screamed at the man.
"No! You are lying!"
He struck the pilot in the head, but the man did not react, so carefully was he watching his gauges. After several more seconds, Henri said,
"It's getting worse!"
Henri did feel an abnormal oscillation in the tail rotor, but he was not, in fact, losing control. He used the opportunity to bank to the right, following the moving map display in front of him to fly along the snowy ridgeline at the top of the valley. He decreased altitude and lowered his speed. The Middle Easterner next to him screamed at him, and the man between the seats behind him shouted as well, but Henri focused on what he was doing. Just as he arrived at the top of the ridgeline, he shouted into his headset,
"Claudette!"
Behind him, Henri's daughter took her opportunity. She unhooked her seatbelt, dove onto the blonde-haired man by the back door, then she kicked her legs out over the side. Shiraz recognized what she was doing. He lunged for her, desperate to take hold of any part of her clothing. The coiled wires of his headset pulled tight just as he got his hand on the cuff of her ski jacket, but gravity was stronger than his grip, and she was out of the helicopter, disappearing over the side. The other men in the back saw the movement, but they were too late to do anything more than lean out over the side and watch her disappear into snowy trees. Her fall was no more than 50 feet, with hundreds of branches to slow her before she hit the powdered drift on the ground. She would break bones and lie in pain for hours, but she would survive. Henri turned back around in his seat when he heard the shouting in Farsi. As he turned, he prayed he would not see his daughter in the cabin, but at first he could not be sure. He saw nothing but arms and legs and the blurred motion of angry men crawling over one another. More screams in his headset told him the men remained agitated, so he had reason to hope, but he could not see the seats directly behind him. It was possible Claudette had been moved. It was not until the men on the starboard side looked down into the trees below, shock and anger and even some fear registering on their faces, that he knew she had done it.
His beautiful, brilliant, brave daughter had fucking done it. His heart had been pounding in terror unceasingly for the last hour, but now it pounded with a father's pride. Henri turned back to the windscreen in front, and he flew the helo over the peak, picking up speed as fast as he could. The little winding valley disappeared below him, and these men would never be able to find it again. Claudette was, if not safe, then at least safe from these murderous terrorists. Now he steeled himself to be as brave as his little girl. He turned to his right and eyed the man called Ajiz, then looked over his shoulder at the little man with the boyish face. They called him Mohammed. He appeared to Henri to be truly the least likely in the group to be in charge of anything, much less these brutes. Mohammed had been focused on the activity in the back. He shouted what were obviously admonitions at his men, only two of whom were wearing headsets and able to hear him. Now Mohammed stopped talking suddenly, and he spun his head to the pilot. Henri stared back at him, a thin, determined smile on his lips. The Iranian's eyes widened. He shouted, "Non!" Henri's smile grew with the terror evident on Mohammed's face. "Oui," he said, grinning now. Henri turned back to the windscreen and sucked in a chest full of air, and he slammed the cyclic forward while pushing the collective to the floor. The Eurocopter pitched down and dove toward the undulating landscape hundreds of feet below. Mohammed screamed in sheer terror while Henri closed his eyes and found himself at peace, thinking about how damn lucky he had been to have lived his life in such a beautiful place as this mountain. Mohammed looked away from the pilot toward a sudden darkness that filled the right half of the windscreen in front of him. A craggy mountain wall was directly in the path of the Eurocopter. A violent jolt from behind told all on board that the tail rotor had struck the rock face. The rotor disintegrated, and the helo spun hard to the left. The main rotor dug into trees, and the aircraft slammed into a forested hillside and tumbled down. Dom had found two Americans still alive in addition to Albright, though both men were badly injured. Several cars full of civilians had appeared at the scene with their own medical kits, and they began treating the wounds to the best of their abilities. Caruso had just returned to Albright and knelt down to help him when he heard a sound to the southeast. It was far in the distance, but unmistakable. It was the low, muffled thump of an impact. The faint but persistent rotor noise of the distant helicopter stopped abruptly. He stood up quickly and spun toward the noise. "They crashed! The helo just went down!" Albright was holding the phone to his ear and gauze against his bloody hip. He'd heard the noise, too. He looked at Caruso. "Go get that asshole. I can treat myself." "You sure?" Albright shouted now. "Go!" The FBI special agent put down his phone and lifted his pistol for Dom to take, but Caruso ignored it. Instead, he scooped up one of the dead HRT members' carbines and dropped the magazine to check the round count. It was fully loaded with 30 rounds, and there was a 3.5 power scope on the rail. Dom ran back to his motorcycle without another word. 49. Mobasheri found himself face down with his forehead buried in snow and his body lying on a broken plexiglass windscreen. He pushed himself up, rising slowly to his knees, and he shook his head to fight the daze from the crash. Looking himself over, he saw that his coat was torn the length of the right arm, and he felt a gash above his elbow. Somehow, he had managed to end up outside the torn fuselage of the helo. The wind blew into his face. Snow melted in his hair. At first he thought it was nighttime. The light was poor, but a quick look around showed him the helicopter had come down in a heavy forest on the hillside. High trees blocked off much of the light above. There was no fire, which surprised Mohammed,
But he remembered learning in his brief military training long ago that helicopters' gas tanks are designed to resist puncture and rarely explode like they do in the movies. His mind recycled back to his mission, and he felt inside his coat for Ross's microdrive. It was there, right in the zipped pocket where he'd left it. So he looked to the left and right, searching for Ethan Ross. He found him still strapped into his seat and suspended sideways in the twisting wreckage. Blood dripped off the American's forehead, but his eyes were open, and he looked around in confusion, and a wash of relief muted Mobasheri's pain. The Iranian crawled over to Ross, pushing his way back into the wreckage to get to him. While he moved closer, he saw that some of his men were moving, either unbuckling themselves from their seats or already out of the twisted EC-145, crawling through the snow. Others lay limp, arms and legs askew. Mohammed unfastened the American's harness, and Ross slid down a few feet, crumpling slowly into a mass of twisted metal and wires.
"Get up!"
Ross's unfixed eyes and pasty white skin gave Mohammed the impression that mild shock had set in, but he did as he was told. As soon as he put weight on his legs to stand, however, he cried out and dropped back to the ground. Mohammed looked down and saw plainly that Ross's right leg was broken 4 inches above the ankle. The Iranian screamed in frustration.
"Madar zinde! Motherfucker!"
He began calling out to the men around him. He didn't know who was alive and who was dead, and he didn't ask who had been injured or incapacitated. He just ordered his people to drag the American from the wreckage. When he finally separated himself from the chaos of the interior of the shredded helicopter, he was able to take stock of his situation. He'd lost one of his Quds Force operatives. It was Kashan, and he was hanging upside down in a nearby tree with a branch impaling his lower torso. And one of the Leon men was caught in the wreckage and near death, unconscious and breathing shallowly. But 3 Quds and 3 Hezbollah remained, including Ajiz, who had also been thrown out the door of the helicopter into the trees but was not badly hurt and had been the first man on his feet. Mohammed joined Shiraz and Ajiz on the hillside a few feet from the wreckage, and together the 3 of them surveyed the crash site. The location looked impossibly remote. They were on a steep, forested incline, with no sign of a road or of any man-made structure in any direction, although they could not see very far. They were surrounded by pines, all of which, save for the ones involved in the crash site, had over 1 foot of snow on their branches. As there was no fire, only steam from the hot engine's contact with the snow threatened to reveal their position, and since the storm continued and the isolated hillside was completely enshrouded in clouds, Mohammed thought it likely the wreckage would stay hidden until the sky cleared. Mohammed trudged and climbed to get around to the front of the helicopter, where he looked through the windscreen. The pilot was alive, but bloodied and badly wounded, half buried under snow and earth, and the front of the helo. It was no matter. Mohammed didn't need him anymore. Ross was the big problem. He ordered 2 of his men to heave the American out of the snow and move him. He told them, in Farsi, of course, that he didn't care if the man was in agony. He just needed to get out of the area. 3 minutes after impact, Mohammed, his men, and his prisoner were moving away from the crash site, albeit painfully slowly. Before he himself left the scene, Mobasheri walked back over toward the pilot, drawing his pistol as he did so. The Frenchman knew about Genoa, so he had to die. Dominic raced his bike to the southwest for almost 10 minutes, making the transition to smaller and smaller roads as he progressed up into the rugged foothills of the Italian Alps. He passed through the town of Pondel, but it was virtually deserted, and other than a smell of wood smoke and a few cars in front of a local market, he detected no signs of life. He spent a minute skidding and sliding on snow-covered streets as he tried to pick his way through the village toward the location of the impact, but soon he was progressing again into the forest. He was doing little more than guessing where he was going, but it was an educated guess. He based the location of the crash on the direction in which the Hilo was traveling when it flew over him, as well as the general location of the sounds of the crash. The road ended at a sheer hiking trail, and Dom revved the engine on the big street bike and launched up the trail. But after no more than 20 yards or so, he realized this had not been one of his better ideas. He spun out on the first turn, lost his balance, and fell ungracefully off the bike and into the low brush by the trail. He decided to leave the bike behind, so he ripped his helmet off his head and began running upward, the M4 rifle still hanging off his back. He followed the winding trail, sucked the thin, cold air, fighting the desire to slow or to rest even for a moment. The trail led him to the south, but he felt like he was veering away from where he had heard the crash. Just as he stopped to consider changing directions, he heard the distinctive report of a pistol firing a single round. Dom left the trail and began climbing through the trees, following the direction of the gunshot. Mobasheri and his entourage traveled through the woods for several minutes, first uphill, but once they made it through a tiny forested draw, they saw a narrow valley in front of them. It was below the low-hanging clouds, and they could look out a few hundred yards before everything faded to white. In the near distance, maybe 200 yards from where they stood in the draw, one of Mohammed's men noticed a cluster of slate rooftops, barely visible in the vapor and snow. They set out for them immediately, Mohammed leading the way. Behind them, far away on the other side of the valley, sirens blared as emergency vehicles roamed the roads looking for a downed helicopter that had been reported by locals. Once they were down the hill and in the bottom of the valley, thick pine trees obscured their view for some time, and Mohammed could only guess if he was going in the right direction. But the slow-moving procession came out of the trees onto a one-lane paved road. Then they followed it as it wound around. Finally, Mohammed saw a chalet through a quick break in the snowfall, and he thought it was a gift from Allah. It looked like the winter cabin for a wealthy family, but there were no signs that anyone was home at present. He said, "There. We go there." Shiraz kicked in a ground-floor window, crawled through, and then opened a side door for the others. It was a small house, but the open-concept floor plan meant the entire downstairs was one large room. The home was very modern for a mountain chalet, with electric lighting, new appliances, and a desk in the corner with a large-screen Mac computer. Mohammed posted two of the Hezbollah men outside as security, and he ordered his 3 Quds officers to help the hobbled and dazed Ethan Ross to a chair in front of the fireplace. Once Ross was in the chair, Mohammed took Ajiz to the far side of the room. "The American is slowing us down. I don't need him. I need the password in his head. As soon as I get it, we are leaving. There were some other buildings up the road. I can go look for a vehicle." "Do that." After Ajiz left the chalet, Mohammed pulled his own chair up in front of Ross. The American was in agony. His broken leg was swollen and throbbing, and it was sickening for Mohammed to look at. Mohammed took the micro drive out of his coat and handed it to Shiraz. He put it in an SD adapter and plugged it into the port of the computer on the desk. He brought up the password protection screen of the crawler database, and then he looked to his commander from the Revolutionary Guards. Mohammed, in turn, looked at Ethan. "Let's not waste time. You know what I need. Provide me with the password to the encrypted files, and we will leave you right here. You will be safe." Ross wiped tears from his face with the cuff of his coat. He shook his head weakly. Mohammed put his foot above Ross's broken leg, and he held it there. "I can't take you with me. Even if we find a car, we won't make it out of the country carrying a wounded American with us. I am out of options. I either get the password right now, or..." Mohammed put his shoe on Ross's foot. "Actually, there is no other choice." He pressed down, and Ross began to scream and thrash on the chair. Mohammed called two of his men over. Ormand and Isfahan stepped behind Ross, and they held him in place, twisting his arms behind his back to do so. Ross screamed in agony, but Mohammed shouted over him, "Give me the password and it stops."
"I can't do it,"
he shouted, hysterical from the pain. Mohammed took his foot off the broken bones and sat back in the chair for a moment.
"You are stronger than I anticipated."
With a shrug, he said something in Farsi. Shiraz rushed into the kitchen. He found a bottle of red wine, and after conferring with Mohammed for a moment, he shattered the end of the bottle against the stove. Wine poured onto the floor, and the broken, jagged-edged bottle emptied. He brought it over to the living area and handed it to Mohammed before returning to the computer at the desk. Ross's eyes rounded in fear, and tears dripped to the floor as he shook his head back and forth. His voice was just a whimper.
"Please, no. God, please, no."
Mohammed sat in front of him with the broken bottle.
"I know something about pain, Mr. Ross. The broken leg hurts, but the shin is not a major nerve center, and the swollen tissue provides a very slight numbing effect on the area that works against my interests. Unfortunately for you, I have seen torture firsthand. My father was something of an expert. He was trained by the state, but he was not above practicing on his children."
When Mohammed smiled, he looked insane to Ethan, especially in light of what he'd just said.
"I know that which is most effective."
He addressed the men behind Ross. "Stand him up and lower his pants."
"No!"
Ross screamed. The men did as instructed. Ross could put weight only on his left leg, but he thrashed, desperate to pull free of the two men behind him. But his struggle was in vain. After a half minute, he stood there with his pants and underwear down at his ankles, and Mohammed in front of him with the crude torture device in his hand.
"Physically and psychologically, what I will do to you now is the worst that can be done to a man. My father never did this to me."
He smiled, but his eyes were narrow as he thought of his past.
"But he threatened it more than once. Only the suggestion was necessary. I did what was asked of me. And now you can do the same. You can avoid this very easily. Just take a moment and think about how unfortunate it would be for you if I shred your genitals and then you reveal the password. That would be an unnecessary waste, would it not?"
Ethan began sobbing, and Mohammed sighed in exhausted frustration. 50. Caruso never saw the wreckage of the helicopter. He passed it in the trees 50 yards on his right, but as he climbed through the woods, he came across the tracks of several men, along with streaks of blood in the snow, and he followed the tracks into a draw between two hilltops. Here not only could he look out into a small valley, but he could also see that Ross and his entourage had done the same, as the tracks and bloodstains indicated they had paused here. Dom used the scope of his rifle to scan a row of roofs he saw in the distance. They looked like chalets arranged in the woods along a road, but he could see nothing more than that. He thought it likely the Iranians holding Ross would head for the buildings in hopes of finding transportation out of the area, and the prospect of them getting away forced Caruso to pick up the pace. He all but ran down the hill, into the trees and toward the road, and while he did so, he attempted to call Adara. He was not terribly surprised to find he had no service here, so he pocketed his phone and told himself he was the only one between the Iranians and their complete and unfettered access to the intelligence scrape. It took Caruso just a few minutes to arrive at the road, and he crossed it carefully, then entered the trees to approach the first chalet unseen. The trees ended just 20 yards from the side of the house, but Dom stayed back another 25 yards to remain deep within the tree line. He saw a man sitting on the steps in the front of the wooden building with a Kalashnikov resting on his knees. He was olive-complexioned, wearing a gray ski jacket and blue jeans, and he looked young and fit, but from the way he handled his weapon,